Former President George H.W. Bush is being buried today in Texas after several days of remembrance. Today at the funeral service in Houston, the choir sang his favorite hymn, Onward, Christian Soldiers. So as we look back on the legacy of the 41st president, how much are we getting right? And how much do we get right about the legacies of all of our former presidents after they die? For a look back at that history, we're joined by Joanne Freeman and Nathan Connolly, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Welcome back.
Hey. Thanks for having us.
And we have to go to the very first one, Joanne, which is President George Washington. How did his legacy evolve after he died?
Well, here's the interesting thing about Washington. I mean, it's no surprise that when he died, his reputation was pretty high, right? He was already the father of his country when he was alive. But what's interesting is that after his death, the Federalist Party tried to manipulate his reputation to boost it, to be even stronger and to be useful to them in a partisan kind of a way. Mm-hmm. So they did all kinds of things like trying to give him full credit for things that he didn't necessarily do on his own. So, for example, the farewell address, his famous farewell address, Alexander Hamilton helped him with that. And the Federalists tried to hide the proof of that from the public and from Hamilton's descendants so that Washington could have full credit for it and so that his reputation would be so powerful that the Federalists could basically use it forever.
Well, and Washington doesn't have a Broadway show, so at least there's that. Hamilton's got the show now so that everybody can hear all about his accomplishments. Nathan, what about a president whose legacy really changed after his death?
Well, one that comes immediately to mind is someone like Andrew Jackson, who was president from 1829 to 37. And, you know, during his life, he was considered to be a champion of the common man. He was a war hero. But also in the context of slavery, he helped to basically democratize a slave institution with accumulating land holdings from Native Americans, making it difficult for central banks to buy land and really, you know, squeeze the common man with loans and such. So the combination of Jackson's Indian policy and his stance against central banks made him very popular in life and, frankly, an enemy of the elite. I mean, the way in which he talked about the tyranny of the banks was thrown right back at him by his enemies who coined him as King Andrew the First. And you can imagine tyranny is kind of like what the Cold War would be relative to communism, right? You just simply throw the epithet around and hope that it sticks effectively. Now, what happens, of course, with Jackson is that even though he has a high reputation, and this is through the 20th century, people are naming schools after Jackson and such, you know, well into the post-World War II period. So you have a number of Americans who see Jackson's name on schools as a marker of, again, the everyman and using it sometimes to displace African Americans in the era of eminent domain and such, you know, land possession. So suffice it to say that in the 1970s, there's a real shift where if you focus on Native American politics and kind of a red power movement, there's a radical reinterpretation of what Jackson means. The Trail of Tears is obviously one of the real negative chapters in American history. And there's an idea that, you know, Jackson should not be remembered for his ability to advance slavery and the slave power to the point now in 2015, 2018 and after, you know, we're thinking about Jackson on the $20 bill and whether or not he should remain at all or be effectively displaced by someone like Harriet Tubman.
But at the same time, we've also got President Trump, who's a huge fan of Andrew Jackson, talks about him all the time, I think has a picture of him in the Oval Office.
Precisely for the reasons that many people thought he was a hero during the 1950s and during the 1830s, right? There's a way in which he represents a particularly narrow vision of American democracy that resonates with part of Trump's base, to be sure.
Okay, let's get to another one that is thought of today as one of the greatest, if not the greatest president we've ever had, and that would be Abraham Lincoln. Was that always the case that he was remembered in that way?
Well, now, it's interesting because, you know, when they poll professors of various sorts and ask them to rate presidents, you're right. Lincoln is always towards the top of those lists. Mm-hmm. But in fact, his reputation had both highs and lows in the wake of his death. Now, of course, he was a wartime president. He was assassinated just a few days after Robert E. Lee surrendered at Appomattox, and we had just had a bloody civil war. So for Northerners, Lincoln really kind of was a martyr for the Union. He had an extremely high reputation. Mm. Not surprisingly, in the South, he was seen as something of a tyrant and had pretty much a negative reputation. And what's
there's that word again.
Yes. There is that word again. And what's interesting is in the South, that persisted for quite some time. So There's a story about in 1910, so we're talking the 20th century, and there was an eighth grader named Oscar Chapman who actually was expelled from his school in Virginia for hanging a portrait of Lincoln in his school. Yeah, and his teacher was shocked. She had to apologize to parents. Little Oscar gets expelled, and the parents ultimately get him back into school not by saying, wait a minute, Lincoln isn't as bad as you're suggesting he is, but rather by saying, well, you failed the curriculum because you didn't teach our son properly the evils that Lincoln did, which is shocking. That's 1910 we're talking about.
But now we've got the Lincoln Memorial in just as prominent a place in Washington as you could say the Capitol and the Washington Monument.
Exactly, exactly. So, and that monument in and of itself was seen as a device or an attempt to unify the nation behind Lincoln, to do so in the nation's capital, so on sort of neutral ground, you could say. But even that attempt had its divisions because the audience that was there watching the memorial get commemorated was segregated. So you end up with the black press saying a segregated audience at that particular moment is the ultimate in hypocrisy, and the white mainstream press basically ignoring that complaint altogether and just praising the unity of the memorial. So even at that moment of unity, there isn't necessarily unity.
I want to ask about one more president, and that is one, the only one, that resigned in office, and that would be Richard Nixon. We actually just visited the Nixon Library in Yorba Linda, California, and did a story about it. And one of the things a historian there said is, you know, Watergate, yes, it was very important, but there was actually a lot more to Nixon's legacy than Watergate. And he started talking about all these great things that Nixon did. What is Nixon's legacy been like throughout these last few decades?
So when Nixon resigned in August of 1974, I mean, his approval rating was somewhere around 24%. So with numbers that low, you know, it can only really go up, right? But if you think about the kind of terrain that Nixon tried to stake out, oftentimes for political expediency, there were a lot of things that were considered to be positive. You know, for one, he was seen as someone who, for instance, tried to unify working classes and elites around basically building a new political coalition for the Republican Party. That meant reaching out to disaffected Southern Democrats. That meant trying to reach out to white moderates by supporting things like affirmative action and even black capitalism, which is an effort to get entrepreneurship to be a real engine of economic growth in communities of color. So all these efforts to build new coalitions effectively made Nixon something of a political, you know, savant. The other thing about this, of course, is that he's supporting environmentalism in ways that might seem out of step with the contemporary GOP, at least. So he creates the Environmental Protection Agency in 1970. He helps to pass the Clean Air Act that same year, Clean Water Act in 72, and the Endangered Species Act of 73. None of this would be considered to be pillars of present-day Republican politics, but we have to look to this as part of Nixon's legacy. Similarly, on foreign policy, he issues a strategy of détente, which is considered to be a really successful negotiation of the Soviet Union, of China. And this is a far cry from what would become, say, the Bush doctrine of preemptive strikes in the early 2000s. So again, as Republican foreign policy goes, he's considered to be much more progressive or at least moderate.
Well, that brings us to today and this week and what we've been thinking about as we've been looking back at the presidency of George H.W. Bush. And Joanne, I think in the back of everyone's mind, as you remember the things that he did, you're looking at President Trump and how much the party, his party, has changed.
Well, right. It's a really interesting moment, culturally and politically, a really interesting moment because the sort of mourning for Bush, so much of it is really appears to be, or it's being made into a moment of people mourning for some sense of decency in politics. They're mourning for something that goes far beyond Bush. And of course, his reputation along the lines of what we're talking about here is being shaped by our current moment and the feelings and problems and controversies and anxieties that people have right now about politics and American society.
Joanne Freeman and Nathan Connolly, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having us.